You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 17th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
All right, well, on this week, in 1885, Huckleberry Finn was published.
Huck Finn.
By noted skeptic Mark Twain.
Absolutely.
Did you guys know he was a big-time skeptic?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just a bit.
He's very quotable.
But the thing is,
Samuel Clemens to his friends, though.
It's true. Not only was he a lover of science, as he showed in like some of his sci-fi-ish novels, like Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, but also recently, I came across a letter he wrote to a snake oil salesman who was trying to peddle some concoction that was supposed to cure a number of diseases, including diseases that Mark Twain's loved ones had recently died of. So he was kind of in a bad mood as it was, and this only made things worse. And he sent back one of the most scathing letters I've ever read, and it's one of those things that, you know, you can read today and use on any number of snake oil salesmen today, and it would be just as perfect and scathing.
He's timeless, is what you're saying.
So here's what Mark Twain wrote. Dear sir, your letter is an insoluble puzzle to me. The handwriting is good and exhibits considerable character, and there are even traces of intelligence in what you say. Yet the letter and the accompanying advertisements profess to be the work of the same hand. The person who wrote the advertisements is without doubt the most ignorant person now alive on the planet. Also without doubt, he is an idiot of the 33rd degree, and scion of an ancestral procession of idiots stretching back to the missing link. It puzzles me to make out how the same hand could have constructed your letter and your advertisements. Puzzles fret me, puzzles annoy me, puzzles exasperate me, and always for a moment they arouse in me an unkind state of mind toward the person who has puzzled me. A few moments from now, my resentment will have faded and passed, and I shall probably even be praying for you. But while there is yet time, I hasten to wish that you may take a dose of your own poison by mistake, and enter swiftly into the damnation which you and all other patent medicine assassins have so remorselessly earned and do so richly deserve. Adieu, adieu, adieu. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, he's awesome.
It's a quintessential Mark Twain.
Send that to a bunch of people we know today.
Yeah, pull that one out the next time someone offers you homeopathy. Yeah,
still relevant today. Well, we're going to revisit the Rom Hoben case. Remember, this is the Belgian man who has been in a coma for the last 23 years following a car accident.
We
reported on him because he was put forward as sort of the face of this research looking at people in a coma, showing that some of them may have more consciousness than is apparent by a traditional neurological exam. But once the media got their hands on this guy, what really came to the fore was the fact that there was a facilitated communicator, this speech therapist, Linda Wooters, who was using facilitated communication with Rom Hoben, and he was saying things like, oh, I've been trapped in here for years, and, you know, the kind of typical things you might imagine somebody in a comatose state might say. Well, we reported on this before. Of course, we didn't buy it for a second. The videos clearly show fake facilitated communication. I mean, she was taking his hand and flying across the computer screen, you know, faster than is really feasible. And even in the worst video, Hoben wasn't even looking at the screen. Interestingly, there's been some follow-up. The neurologist in the case, Stephen Larais, who initially endorsed the facilitated communication as evidence that Hoben was conscious, said at the time that he tested the FC, for example, showing him a key, and then with the facilitator he, you know, typed out the word key. Again, we thought, yeah, he got snookered, right? He just didn't buy it. The test couldn't have been legitimate. Well, it turns out that Dr. Larais did some more rigorous testing of the communication from Rom Hoben, and when properly blinded, Hoben was unable to name any of 15 objects. He got 0 out of 15 on a properly blinded test.
Oh, I guess he shouldn't have blinded it then, huh?
Yeah. And interesting, you know, I was just interviewed on NPR All Things Considered, which was on tonight, but you can listen to it online. I'll link to it off my bio page. And Larrez was interviewed too, and he admitted that, you know, Hoban could not perform at all. And also said, like, previously when he tried to test Hoban, to test the FC, the Hoban would write things through the facilitator, such as, "You don't believe me, and I don't want to be tested," which is the kind of things...
Isn't that convenient?
The facilitator would say, yeah.
It's awful suspicious.
Yeah,
I think this facilitator needs a salary.
Well, the interesting thing, though, is that often... I mean, I thought in this case that the facilitator is just as fooled as the guy is.
Not all the time.
As the doctor. But yeah, that kind of makes it sound like maybe not. No.
That's like ignore the man behind the curtain, right? Yeah. I mean, that's pretty bad.
Although I think you could probably still do something like that subconsciously, you know.
I agree. Although Larrez is saying that he tested 3 of his patients in this way, 2 failed, but that one, he said, showed legitimate communication through facilitated communication. So he's still holding on to FC being legitimate in some cases. But I don't have the details of that. It hasn't been published anywhere. He just presented it at some meeting. And he's not really talking.
That's like, well, my psychic is real, but your psychic isn't.
Yeah, yeah. So I still think he doesn't quite get it. At least he admitted that the Hoban case was not legitimate. Also, he acknowledged that Ram Hoban was one of the subjects of a recent paper that we talked about where they used the functional MRI scanning to see if they could communicate sort of yes and no style to certain patients who appear to be comatose, and that Ram Hoban failed that test as well. So it may be that Hoban really isn't conscious. You know, these 2 more rigorous tests of his consciousness have been negative, despite, you know, Larrez's protestations previously that it was clear that Hoban was conscious.
Steve, what inspired the doctor to do a more rigorous scientific study on this?
I mean, I believe it's the backlash that there was, you know, worldwide against the facilitated communication. I mean, I don't think he realized what he was stepping into. I think, again, he was just sort of naive of what FC is and still is to some degree. So
yeah, still holding out hope.
And I think he believed that the test was going to validate it. I think he really thought that we'd do a rigorous test and it would validate the FC with Hoban. But to his credit, it was negative and he reported it.
I wonder if he's holding out hope or just trying to save face. Because I think it looks a little bit better if you know, at least...
Yeah.
You know, put it out there. Well, you know, but it could be true.
Or he's slowly coming to grips, right?
Yeah.
I'm guessing
at a time
that
he's starting to accept that, this isn't really working.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how many times do you get disappointed, or do you think maybe there's some legitimacy to something, or you underestimate the degree of self-deception or maybe even deliberate deception of people, and only to have rigorous testing show that it's fake before you start to get the skeptical attitude, like, oh, here we go, another FC case. Of course it's going to be fake. Do some legitimate testing and we'll shoot this one down too, right? But he's starting from scratch. He thought it was all real. And now the one case that was, you know, getting all the attention, he admits, was not real. But that's not enough, I think, to beat it out of him. He's still, I think, holding it out. But we'll see. I mean, again, there's a glimmer of hope in that he did a good test and acknowledged the results, unlike a crank who would ignore the results
or skew them,
dismiss them or distort the results, and would continue in the original claim. So I do think he's a legitimate scientist, but... Man, he's holding on to this FC thing, and he really, you know, should have gotten up to speed by this point, I think, on it. And also, for our listeners who don't know what FC is, we've been talking about it without defining it. Facilitated communication is the process of assisting the hand or the arm of someone who is physically or cognitively impaired in order to help them point to letters on a keyboard or a computer screen or a letter board. The problem is that when tested, it seems that the facilitator is the one doing all of the communicating, and that they may be subconsciously moving the hand, directing it towards letters in what we call the ideomotor effect, or subconscious muscle movements. I also should point out that I learned that Stephen LeRae's subsequent rigorous testing of FC in this case was done with the assistance of the Belgium skeptics, and specifically Willem Betz, who's a physician and skeptic. So the skeptics were directly involved in this follow-up testing of this case.
Well, Steve, I've been thinking about that. I made the initial observation that you did, saying, well, you know, he did go back and do real science, and he admitted it and everything. And I think publicly, it's probably a very good thing that he did that, right? And some people might actually change their minds about FC after they read his second comments about it. But, you know, from a skeptical perspective, the guy failed. And he's continuing to fail. And right. You know, he is a doctor, and he should understand science well enough to not have failed in the first place, in my opinion.
Yeah, but I think, in my opinion, it raises the point that being a scientist does not necessarily include the skill set of being a skeptic. And you could be a scientist without being a skeptic, meaning you know how to do good science, but that doesn't necessarily protect you from deliberate or subconscious or psychological deception or fraud, right? So as has been observed before, the bacteria in the petri dish aren't trying to deliberately fool you. But here we have a facilitated communicator who was, whether consciously or subconsciously, was doing something extremely deceptive, and he was fooled by it because it's not something that a scientist necessarily has to deal with.
Yeah, but now he knows. He exposed the facilitated communicator for what the person is, but he's still believing that another patient, a third patient, is doing it, probably with a different facilitated communicator, right? It may be another person, I hope.
It probably is. Yeah, I don't know the details. But yeah, he's not generalizing from that one case. He's saying, well, FC itself, you have to do it case by case. You have to assess it case by case.
And one more point. Didn't he Google this? You know, didn't he go on and read about it? You know,
Well, Jay, it's not only that. I mean, I reached out to him. I've gotten emails from some other colleagues who have reached out to him. And now he's essentially saying, well, I don't want to discuss this except in the peer-reviewed literature and at meetings and stuff. But then he's talking to NPR and to Der Spiegel. You know, he's talking to media outlets.
Yeah, right.
But not his colleagues who are trying to help him out to sort through this a little bit more. I don't know. It's weird.
Can't have it both ways. Is he an MD, Steve, or is he a PhD?
Yeah. No, MD. No, I don't know if he's a PhD as well. He's at least an MD. He may be an MD-PhD, but he's an MD and a neurologist and a researcher.
Steve, did you actually communicate with him directly on NPR?
No, we were interviewed separately.
No, he used a woman with a keyboard.
Yeah, he took the doctor's hand and ran it over.
Led to some misunderstandings.
We were interviewed separately, but I heard his part. I heard the segment, so I heard his part of the interview. And the interviewer told me what he said, too, when he was talking to me. So even some more information than what was aired. And also, Trina Suderos is going to write up the story for the Chicago Tribune, and she interviewed me about it as well. So it is getting a lot of press. And I think this story plus the Desiree Jennings story, did we talk about the follow-up on the show about that as well? I don't remember. Now she has like an Australian accent.
Yeah, we did.
It was hysterical. I know I shouldn't laugh at those people, but oh man, that was funny. Just suddenly adopting a crazy accent.
Yeah. This is the girl who thinks that she got dystonia from a flu vaccine, and you know, my position has been it's not dystonia. It looks like.
Wait a minute. Does Jay have dystonia? Maybe that would explain the terrible accent.
Well, I was going to. Is it a better accent than Brian Dunning's accent, you know, that he tried?
Well, it pretty much have to be, wouldn't it?
He did a pretty good job. Come on. At least he's trying.
I don't think we can be the judge of that.
Give him a C.
Give him a
Sorry,
D.
Sorry, Brian.
But in both these cases, though, there's a lot of mainstream coverage coming off of the science blog coverage of these stories. So I think that this is a good sign that our skeptical activities are starting to spin off serious, good mainstream
coverage. So what you're saying is science-based medicine is working.
And the blogs and the podcasts are all generating, I think, Because as successful as they are, the mainstream media still has an order of magnitude or more exposure. So it's great when our voices get magnified or echoed in things like Inside Edition. You know, 2020 is coming up. Chicago Tribune, LA Times, NPR. It's good. It's all good.
Clearly you're on a bunch of people's Rolodexes, Steve. So that's a good thing.
Yes, which is it's a good thing for anyone. And this is something that we've actually been trying to do. Is, you know, if you read that book, like How Scientists Can Deal with the Media, that's one of the things they tell you to do. Is, and I do this whenever I talk to a reporter or a journalist, I make sure I follow up at the end. Please, here's my contact information. Contact me for any similar stories that they come up. You become a resource. And this is the payoff. So, yeah, it works. Well, Bob, let's go on to the next story. Tell us about the latest solar energy breakthrough, because you know we have to talk about every solar energy breakthrough.
Well, that's funny you say that, because I disagree. There's so many of these new solar breakthroughs that we have to definitely pick and choose. And really, when they're especially compelling, will it kind of bubble up to our attention, where we realize that, yeah, let's talk about this one.
Yeah, I know. I was being
right.
Sarcastic.
Yeah. There's just so much of this stuff, which I think is a great sign. When, you know, literally every day you could probably find something about it. But people are calling this new advance silicon whiskers or micro carpets, and a few other terms. It refers to a new type of solar cell researchers have recently announced, involving the creation of a new flexible nanowire-based technology that's at least as efficient as currently available silicon solar tech, but uses only about 1% of the silicon. Which is really a pretty cool advance if you know about the cost of silicon, how hard it is to work with it. This is announced in the journal Nature Materials by our good buddies at Caltech. Actually, we don't know anybody at Caltech. I wish we did. Harry Atwater.
Shermer's from Caltech.
Well, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, he counts.
There you
okay.
go.
Okay, good. All right.
So
but somebody there.
But Shermer wasn't involved with this research. No. I suspect.
Well.
So one of the main guys here is Harry Atwater. He's the Howard Hughes Professor of Applied Physics and Material Science, and Director of Caltech's Resnick Institute. He said that these solar cells have, for the first time, surpassed the conventional light-trapping limit for absorbing materials. This was really interesting. The light-trapping limit apparently is the amount of light a specific material can absorb. And according to Atwater, he says that these arrays can absorb 96% at specific wavelengths and 85% of all collectible light, which sounded almost too good to be true when I read this. And it's still a point of confusion a bit, which I'll get to a little bit later.
But Bob, can I say now, is that the difference between the light that it collects and the amount of that light that it converts into electricity? So saying that it's collecting 90% of the light doesn't mean it's 90% efficient.
Right. It's a two-step
yeah.
process. You're right.
Right.
Black paint is great at absorbing light, but you're not going to get any, you know, there's no charge carriers associated
yes,
with it, so
right.
you're not going to get much current. So that must be it. It must be, well, according to Atwater, it's efficient at gathering the light and utilizing it as well. So it's kind of like a, you know, the perfecta in solar cell tech, which is really what you want. But still, it's a little bit confusing. I'll get to that a little bit later. But he said that we've surpassed previous optical microstructures developed to trap light. So clearly, this is a pretty cool advance. So how does this work? Basically, imagine like a forest of minuscule wires or rods sticking up. I guess a carpet is an apt analogy. So you've got these silicon wires standing up that intercept light, causing it to bounce around kind of inside the wires. And apparently, when the light hits the interior surface at a specific angle, it gets absorbed. So it just kind of bounces around a bit until it's absorbed, producing the electrons, which is what, you know, the photoelectric effect is. The biggest problem, though, with this kind of technology was that when the light is directly overhead, if you can imagine light directly overhead over a carpet, if the fibers of the carpet stood straight up, basically the light's really not going to be hitting the sides of the fibers. It's going to kind of hit just really the end. And so it was very inefficient when the light was arranged that way, which is kind of bizarre, right? Can you imagine a solar cell that works at dusk, but it doesn't work at noon, which is kind of silly, because at noon is where you have all the direct light. So that was bad. That was really bad. But they came up with an ingenious resolution to this problem.
They turned it on its side?
No, that would have been one way to solve it. What they did was around these wires, these rods, is a polymer substrate. It's kind of all over the place. And they put these nanoparticles of, what was this stuff, aluminum oxide, throughout this this polymer. All right, so you got these nanoparticles that are kind of frozen in place in this substrate, and when the light hits it at pretty much at any angle, no matter what angle the incident light is, it's bouncing off these particles. They go flying all over the place. They hit the rods or the whiskers or whatever you call them, and they get absorbed. So it greatly increased the efficiency of this thing. So that was pretty much their resolution to this. Now it's important to note that this is just a proof of concept. These guys didn't create a fully functional solar cell or panel or anything like that. It's really a lab demonstration. It's a very compelling demonstration, but that's what it is at this point. The next step is to increase the size and make this a fully functioning solar cell. And they claim that they're actually very close to doing this and demonstrating that a big cell works just as well as those smaller lab demonstrations that they've done so far. We've actually one minor critic that I could find, Keith Barnum of Quantum Photovoltaics Group at Imperial College London. He says that it's not a foregone conclusion that this is going to work when it's scaled up. That a lot of times you'll have material defects that can wreak havoc with your cell performance. But he is still very hopeful, saying that by demonstrating that they can get an efficient current, the group is halfway there though, and that's great. So he's still somewhat confident. One thing that confused me about this was the efficiencies. I read earlier to you about the absorption is 96% of specific wavelengths and 85% of all collectible light, and elsewhere Atwater said that it's very good and efficient at making these charged carriers. But then elsewhere, I'll read stuff like this. We have shown the optical absorption efficiency is comparable to a conventional silicon cell, which is like 15 to 25%. So I'm not sure how those two thoughts are reconciled. So I guess there's still, even though it seems very, very incredibly efficient, still I guess when you scale it up and consider how very little, you know, silicon there is, that you're still only going to get comparable to conventional silicon solar technology. But that's still great because you're using literally a hundredth of the silicon. Silicon is expensive and it's brittle, and so using this new technology could greatly reduce the cost of silicon solar cells. And
so, Bob, did they give any projections on when it's going to be available, or did they just discover this?
I heard some number. I heard some numbers of a few years. We might see something interesting with this. I mean, they're almost ready, it seems, to create a functioning solar cell. So that's, if they're close to doing that, then it, you know, who knows? It could be just a few years or so, or 5 years before this really takes off. If there's no other impediments, but
it is still frustrating because, you know, when I was reading up on this story too, I was doing some Googling. I found good, you know, very promising solar
years ago,
tech
right?
stories from 4 or 5 years ago. I was like, well, where are they now? You know, these things I think mainly don't pan out, or it may be an interesting technological advance in one respect, but there are other deal killers out there that somehow don't get mentioned, you know, in when the articles are telling how great it is. But it is interesting to think about the many different ways in which we need technological breakthroughs here. And we tend to get focused on things like efficiency. How, you know, what's the conversion efficiency? Is it 9%, 10%, 15%? But there's other things that are as or more important. And this is
absolutely
one that many people wouldn't think of: material efficiency, using 1% of the silicon, because, you know, silicon, as you say, it's kind of expensive. And also, of course, you know, how rare and expensive are the materials. I mean, there are other solar cells that look great on paper, but they use
gallium arsenide. Yeah. Silicon is one of the best. You could actually make solar cells out of lots of different materials, including gallium arsenide and others. But they're generally not going to, you know, be as efficient in terms of creating these charge carriers and stuff, and they're going to be more expensive. So that's why silicon is so popular with solar technology.
Yeah. So you almost need everything to come together. The materials have got to be cheap. It's got to be flexible and durable, or, you know, at least durable. The cost per kilowatt has got to be good. And it's got to scale up to mass production. And it seems like we're nibbling around the edges, but no one's put all of the pieces together to make the really breakthrough solar. Of course, you could put solar on your roof right now, and that would be fine. But
right.
nothing really breakthrough like this where you'd be insane not to do it. You know, it'd be so energy and cost effective.
Yeah. Well, that's why I love the fact that there's so many different ways of approaching this, and they're investigating. It's not like they're picking, you know, remember like the hydrogen economy? Yeah, let's focus just on that and forget everything else. Oh, wait a second. it's not a, you know, it's a storage medium. It's not a source of energy. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, we can't really store it really effectively.
Right. Let the market decide. Let them try out. And then with so many
irons in the fire.
Yeah, with so many irons in the fire, one, you know, you just increase the odds that one of them is going to hit.
Yeah, that's true. But it's a frustrating process to watch because there's so many dead ends and so
right.
many, you know, so much, I think, hype in here. It's hard to work yeah. through it.
But the payoff, just think of the payoff. I think we should increase our research in order of magnitude or two in this stuff.
Mm. And all these articles seem to start with there's enough sunlight falling on
right.
the Earth to
in one hour to
run the world for a year,
the
you
world.
Know,
or something
yeah,
crazy
but,
like
you
that.
Know,
right.
Keep in
world.
Mind with that okay. statement. I know what you're getting at, but you know the Earth needs that radiation too. We can't take all of it.
Of course not. It's just a theoretical
yeah.
upper limit.
Really, I thought we were just going to build a dome over the planet to
just some pie in the sky.
Absorb yeah. the energy.
A sphere. Yes.
Somebody puts a solar cell array over your garden. I'm going to take your light.
I think Mr. Burns did that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's right.
He blocked out the sun.
Hey, Joe says hi. Say hi again, Joe.
Which Joe?
Hey, guys. Your long-lost brother, Joe.
Hey, Joe.
Joe Novella?
The mystery Novella.
Twin brother of Bob Novella on the podcast?
The mystery brother?
The fraternal twin.
Joe. I don't really know how I feel about
this. Oh, nice.
See you guys later.
See you, Joe.
Bye.
Joe Novella.
Joe Novella, ladies and gentlemen.
Yay.
So, Evan.
Yeah.
Tell us about this killed psychic.
Oh, well, I'll do more than that. I'll play some introduction music that is appropriate to this to the story here. Here we go. Here we go. Yeah. Psycho killer. Yeah. So the Talking Heads back in 1977 wrote about psychic killers.
Yeah. Psychic killer.
And psychic killer, qu'est-ce que c'est? Sorry, my daughter was reminding me that the word killer is a bad word. All right. And headline reads, woman killed psychic over failed love spell. So a woman in the United States back in April of 2005, she consulted a psychic. She didn't quite like the result that she got from this particular psychic. So, like any, you know, person who doesn't get a psychic reading that, you know, agrees with them, they, what do? They drive across country and murder the psychic for giving them a bad.
God. There you go.
Yeah, that's not fiction. This actually happened in April 2005. And the woman just the other day was found guilty by a court. And she stands, she's facing
How'd
the
she
death
do
penalty.
It?
For this. She had an accomplice, and together they traveled across the country.
Really? Because you would think that would be the kind of a lone nut job kind of a deal. But she had somebody working with her?
Yeah, well, you see, she promised this fellow. The woman's name, by the way, is Tanya Nelson, and she convinced her accomplice, Philippe Zamora. She was able to convince him to come and do this because she promised him that she would hook him up with gay sex.
I see. But, you know, it also says here that they stabbed not only the psychic, Jade Smith, to death, but her daughter.
Yeah, her daughter, too, unfortunately, was a victim of this.
The collateral damage.
Jade Smith was a victim, and Anita Vo, her daughter, ages 52 and 23. It's a pretty unbelievable story when, you know, you think you'd tell someone about this, and they would say, nah, that really didn't happen. That's a myth. That's a, you know, you're exaggerating or something. No. here's an example. You know, we usually talk about, in examples of pseudoscience that kills, how the victims, like the person who was, say, getting the fortune told, somehow, you know, wound up being the ultimate victim, either being badly wounded or dead somehow. But in this case, is the actual psychic, the purveyor of the paranormal.
But I still feel like there's pieces of information missing here. So how much money did the psychic bilk from this woman? I mean, was that the motive? I mean, did she get bilk like tens of thousands of dollars from her, or like $100? I mean, that would sort of put a different spin on this story. You know what I mean?
It was not reported as to how much she got bilked, essentially, but for this, or how much she was charging for her readings.
Mm-hmm.
She just simply didn't like the fact that she had that the psychic had told her that the psychic could not change reality for her.
Right? Yeah.
So she wrote it in a letter to her. So she gave her the reading, and then they had some correspondence. She wrote back to her and said, "Look, the psychic said I cannot change reality." You know, which is kind of a strange thing for a psychic to say,
right,
in a way, on its own. You know, this woman snapped. She was a twig ready to snap, and that was
it. I agree with Steve.
Sounds like a grip on reality was kind of
there's something
to begin
missing
with
from this story.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it does show you a good example of, you know, like just how far out some people can be. And, you know, just like Steve was saying, that was it. She just got pushed over the edge right there. I mean, I guess she was already at the end of her rope probably before she went to the psychic, because whatever she was wanting changed was pushing her really hard. But, yeah, that person definitely has emotional problems.
You know, and after they murdered them, they made off with a lot of the victim's jewelry and possessions and credit cards. They tried to cover up.
Sounds very premeditated. Yeah, this wasn't a crime of passion here we're talking about.
That's this week's How Pseudoscience Kills.
Evan, will you please play for us Who's That Noisy?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that right now, in fact.
Let's.
Here we go. Someone guessed that was bacon frying in a pan.
No, it isn't.
No.
Cricket bacon.
No.
It's ice cracking.
No, it's not ice cracking.
It's a slinky.
No, that was last week's.
Some other people thought we took the prior week's noisy and
sped it up
or manipulated it somehow. No, we didn't do that either. No, what this is natural VLF radio emissions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, our planet generates lots of noise from across the radio spectrum. Thunderstorms, for example, are a natural source or a main source of these natural radio emissions. This is the recording called a tweak, in which these are strikes that are reflected off the Earth's ionosphere, and they come up as part of, for example, an AM radio transmission.
So this is the radio signals from lightning strikes?
Yes.
I see.
That's exactly what it is.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
Now, what I learned also since I introduced this noisy is that the same effect happens through other means as well. For example, aurora borealis can cause the exact same phenomenon. It can be it can be picked up and have the exact same effect on these radio frequencies, or it effectively sounds the same.
Mm-hmm.
And then I assume the aurora australis as well.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt about it. And so, yeah, and so in that context, it was someone who thought of the aurora borealis and actually, you know, was able to look it up and guessed correctly that these were low-frequency radio noises. And that was Azink, A-Z-I-N-Y-K. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Or Azinik.
Well done.
Cool. That was a hard one.
That was hard.
What do you got for this week?
This week?
Oh, Steve, it's always, what have you done for me lately?
Yeah, well, what's happened this week?
I know, I'm a taskmaster.
What
happened? Come on.
Right, guys.
That's a disturbing image. Thanks.
Now, okay, Steve, Jay, and Bob, you guys, well, maybe not Jay, you guys should get this. Here you go.
However, scientists tell us that it will be many years before space travel becomes a reality.
Okay, that's it.
Very distinctive voice.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Very distinctive to a more mature crowd, shall we
yes.
say.
Yeah, and the accent definitely places it within historical time, which is I always find interesting.
Really?
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
So good luck, everyone.
Well, thanks, Evan. Let's do a couple of questions and emails. These are both some follow-up from last week. The first one comes from Joe Colombo from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And Joe writes, "Hey guys, I was just listening to your latest episode in the lab and had a comment on your thinking on the carbon capture for formation of gasoline. While you all made the point that there would be energy lost in this process, it seems that this might be used to make gasoline for cars. While it would be amazing for all cars to have mini nuclear reactors in them, this seems slightly impractical for the near future. However, if we can use nuclear or solar, et cetera, plants to make gas, it will solve the drilling problem even if there is energy lost for the fuel. Anyway, love the show. Brian makes a good rogue." Well, thanks, Joe. This is representative of lots of feedback that we got from that segment. So I wanted to delve into this topic a little bit more. And Joe and the others are correct in that, you know, we were focusing on a specific claim, which is using some alternate energy source, like, say, a nuclear power plant, in order to capture carbon dioxide from the exhaust of coal-burning power plant smokestacks, and then converting that carbon into gasoline so that it could then be burned in cars. And my point was, That's a complete waste, because the laws of thermodynamics tell us that every time you convert energy from one form to another, there's a certain inefficiency in that. You're going to lose some of that energy. So it seems like an awful lot of processes. If your goal is to minimize CO2 in the atmosphere to create energy, then just use the nuclear power directly for electricity. Don't burn the coal in the first place. So that process is kind of silly. To make it more obvious, it'd be like using nuclear energy to make coal from the CO2 from a coal-burning plant. You know what I mean? You're sort of going around in a circle, wasting energy every step of the way. And the CO2 winds up in the atmosphere eventually anyway, so it doesn't really make sense from a CO2 point of view, and it's inefficient. However, a lot of people brought up the point that, well, what if we need the gasoline, though? So I broke this down a little bit further when I blogged about it. I said it really depends on what your purpose is. If you're looking for an energy source, you have to be clear this is not a source of energy. Just like hydrogen is not a source of energy, right? The hydrogen economy, it was never about using hydrogen as a source of energy, but only as a energy storage medium. Gasoline is a mighty fine energy storage medium. It's stable at a range of temperatures. It's energy dense. It combusts nicely. So, if your goal is to store energy, and you have a reasonably efficient process of doing so, this process may have some utility. But still, I don't know if this is ever going to play a role, because when you think about it, while we're still burning coal to make electricity, any nuclear, wind, solar, geothermal, whatever energy that we can produce, we're probably better off just dumping that into the grid and reducing our dependence on coal burning, power reduction. We don't need to make gasoline to run our cars, because we have gasoline. It's pretty cheap and abundant, at least for now. One can envision a future in which, let's say, we're really getting low on oil and we're still trying to fly jets that need jet fuel, and we'll need to make the jet fuel because, we can't run jets off of electrical batteries or hydrogen or some other alternate fuel. And therefore, we may need to use an energy inefficient process in order to make jet fuel in order to fly our jets. So that's where this kind of technology may be useful, but not in the ways that are being proposed, which I think were a bit of a scam to capitalize on the CO2 sequestration notion. It still makes more sense. If you're going to sequester CO2, then you want to put it into some kind of a solid medium where it will be sequestered for a long period of time. You don't want to put it into gasoline where you're just going to burn it and put it right back into the atmosphere again.
Right.
And make products out of it.
Yeah, make stuff out of it. Make plastic or whatever. So yeah, it just depends on what your goals are. Energy storage, energy creation, or CO2 sequestration, or just minimizing putting CO2 in the atmosphere. I think it's useful to think about as lots of energy proposals are being made, biofuels, hydrogen, these kind of things, et cetera, to think through all of the steps from beginning to end. Where's the energy coming from? How is it being converted? How is it being stored? How is it being used? And then only then do you really get a sense of whether or not it's practical and efficient. Again, that kind of analysis and actually trying to write it down as an equation about where the energy is coming from and going, I think is a very useful exercise. Let's go on to the second email. This is a follow-up on Thomas Paine. We got a few emails about this. I'm going to read one from Mark Feralis from Los Angeles. And Mark writes, in your last show, you identified Thomas Paine as an American pamphleteer and revolutionary. He was a pamphleteer and a revolutionary, but he was most certainly not an American, at least not when he published Common Sense. Little known facts, Thomas Paine was born in England and even worked for an English government at one point. In 1774, he was fired, went bankrupt, and his wife divorced him. Since his life was ruined, he saw a new beginning by moving to the United States in November of 1774. Mark, the United States didn't exist in 1774.
But we know what you mean.
But we know what you mean. He ended up publishing
We're
Common
not
Sense.
Tenants.
No, no. In January.
We're not writing you any emails, correct?
He ended up publishing Common Sense in January or February of 1776, which meant that he had been in America only 14 months at the time. Not hard to see why he wrote what he wrote, since he had an axe to grind against Parliament. Yes, he played a huge role in the Revolutionary War, but I don't see how 14 months of living in a new country can turn a British dude into an American colonial. I know you enjoy trivia, just saying. Keep up the good work.
We got a couple of emails because we referred to Thomas Paine as some guy with pamphlets. People, please, have
a tongue.
I know it's difficult for us to ask you to have faith, you know, seeing as we're a skeptical podcast and all, but... Please, we're not idiots.
Well, I mean, it made me wonder, because Thomas Paine is a famous founding father, almost the sometimes given credit as being like the father of the Revolution. And do people outside the United States not recognize how famous he is in the United States?
That they I'm can outside actually think, the United States.
And you know what I mean? You're an expat. I mean, like actual British people. Do they not realize? I just assumed.
Enough.
That he didn't get the sarcasm because he didn't recognize that how silly it would be for us not to know who Thomas Paine was, right?
Maybe. Yeah, I guess so.
He wrote The Rights of Man when he was in London, you know.
Yeah, I get the feeling he's pretty famous on both sides of the ocean.
Yeah.
And in France, too.
Yep.
You know, his writings were very important in revolutionary France in the 1790s, you know, of course, the book The Age of Reason is his critique on institutionalized religion, and, you know, it's what we as skeptics kind of point to and embrace, and we take Thomas Paine sort of under our wing as well as, there was a good skeptic and, you know, someone who, you know, who was one of the early founders who understood and who got it.
Yeah, he was a deist. And the Age of Reason was not just a knock on organized religion, but specifically Christianity in America.
How about this, though? He was imprisoned in France in December of 1793, and he was afraid he was going to get executed. Part of his defense, and he heavily pressed this, is that he was not, and one of the reasons I'm sure he believed that he was imprisoned is that because they felt him a British citizen.
Mm-hmm.
He argued successfully that he was not a British citizen, that he was in fact a citizen of America.
Right.
And that helped him get him off the hook in France, because he was able to successfully argue that in their court of law. So
he was an American.
Exactly.
Come on. Yeah. I mean, the guy, he moved to the colonies prior to it becoming the United States of America in 1776. He was, you know, in the government. He was an American. Come on.
And he was, you know, he's good friends with Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah.
Who?
You know, and Thomas Jefferson.
He was some guy who owned slaves, right?
Right. Yeah.
So what's the takeaway here? Am I correct in saying that the takeaway is either generally we are always right or we're just pretending to be stupid? One of those two, generally?
Both.
No, we just wanted to use this as an opportunity to discuss a figure that we really haven't talked about on the show.
Did you just
really
say opportunity?
Opportunity.
Opportunity.
to talk about a skeptic and humanist who was, you know, key to founding this country. You know,
it was an unbelievable time in history. You know, the late 1700s. You know, obviously not just for what was going on in America, but what was really happening, you know, all over sort of Western civilization, as it were. It was the age of enlightenment, you know, coming to, you know, sprouting forth into these new systems of governance.
He once said, "My own mind is my own church." I always liked that quote.
Ooh,
that's nice. And he knew how to use sarcasm. He actually wrote a satire of somebody defending monarchy, saying that without monarchy, government would deteriorate into a democracy.
That's Franklin-esque.
That is awesome.
You think he ever got emails on that quote?
You know, I love learning about the founders of the United States, and to know that they were deists and they understood the limitations of government, which includes the limitations of religious authority as well, goes right hand in hand with that. You know, these are very important people in amazing time in history. And I find it fascinating. Yeah. Him, Franklin.
Let's do one more question. This one comes from Jess LaSalle from Syracuse, New York. And Jess writes, "Hello all. Let me first say I love the show. I started listening around the time Rebecca became a rogue, and I haven't missed an episode since. My question came to me while I was watching the ABC show Lost. People are constantly being knocked unconscious in the show and remain unconscious for long stretches of time. So my question is this. Is it really that easy to be knocked unconscious? Do you really remain unconscious for such a long time? And do you really wake up without any permanent or prolonged damage? Steve, since you are a neurologist, I thought you may be able to answer this. Thanks for everything you do and keep up the good work." Yep, this is an interesting question. It's one of those common TV myths that crop up a lot.
And Lost is a good example, too, because there are a lot of people on Lost getting knocked out.
Yeah, that's right.
Every week.
Or 24, you know, Jack Bauer, whack people in the back of the head and knock them unconscious. Obviously, you can knock people unconscious by hitting them in the head. And you know, this happens quite frequently with car accidents where people hit their forehead, for example, on the windshield or in any kind of, you know, significant injury where you hit your head. Interestingly, like one of the other TV conventions is that they're always out for however long they need to be out for as a plot device, right?
Absolutely, yep.
Whereas the duration of unconscious relates to how severe the head injury was. Interestingly, as a neurologist, when I take a history of somebody who had a head injury, you always find out if they had a loss of consciousness. And whether or not the person lost consciousness is a good rule of thumb for a serious enough injury to cause actual permanent brain injury. So in other words, if somebody did not lose consciousness, they're probably okay. If they did lose consciousness, then they probably sustained some brain damage.
Well, Steve, one question I would add here is what exactly happens to the brain when you're unconscious? And I assume you'd probably talk about that anyway, because it's clearly what, you know, what's going on. You're not asleep. You know, it's not like, I mean, is it similar to some sort of effects from drugs, or what exactly is going on?
Yeah, it's actually probably closest to a coma in that, you know, the brain slashes around inside your head and all of the neurons are stunned. They're physically traumatized and stunned. If the injury is severe enough, you can get what's called diffuse axonal injury, where there's actually like little micro tears throughout the brain.
Ouch.
Yeah, and that causes difficulty with memory and concentration and cognitive ability and can cause chronic headaches.
Is that damage permanent? I assume the little tears would eventually heal, but is there any permanent memory damage from that?
There can be, absolutely. Some people report that, you know, they never go back to the way they were before the injury. They especially have a hard time with multitasking or with learning new information. You know, I have people tell me that they can read the same page 10 times and just the information is not getting in there.
Wow.
There's a range, you know, of disability. Again, the duration of a consciousness tends to correlate fairly well with that. So if you're knocking somebody out and they're out for a couple of hours, being knocked out for a couple of hours, that's a serious brain injury. You know, they're not going to just wake up with a little bit of headache, rub their skull, and then go on with the plot line, right? When they do wake up, they may be encephalopathic or delirious, like basically still out of it for a period of time. They may not come immediately back and you know, just wake up like they were waking up from being asleep. Yeah, they probably will have some permanent symptoms. Sometimes it can take months for the symptoms to go away, but they eventually will and they'll be fine. And other times they'll be permanent. Of course, repeatedly getting hit in the head hard enough to be knocked unconscious is a good way to get cumulative brain damage. There's a lot of talk.
Punch drunk?
Yeah.
Punch drunk?
Punch drunk. I mean, yeah, the technical term for that would be dementia pugilistica, where people like boxers will actually develop dementia from being knocked out a lot of the times. Or even if they're not knocked out, even just getting repeatedly hit in the head could still cause an injury. Just cumulative over time. And then, you know, after a long career of getting punched in the head, you know, they accrue, slowly accrue damage, and the cumulative effect is they have a dementia, you know, just like if somebody with Alzheimer's disease type of symptoms. There's a lot of attention being paid to contact sports like football when players suffer a concussion, which, you know, the concussion is basically a bruised brain, but it's essentially what we're talking about, that, you know, getting knocked out because of physical trauma, that the brain can take 2 to 3 weeks to really recover. And that even when players may feel better after a few days, the neurons are still a little stunned. They're still recovering from the injury. And it may take them a couple of more weeks before they really get back to normal. And if the player sustains another injury while the neurons are in the process of recovering, then they could be even more damaged. You know, it's like a double hit.
Right.
They're not quite there. They're still struggling to repair themselves. They get hit again. They have less reserve, and that compounds the injury. And, you know, that results in a lot of chronic cognitive problems. You know, so this is like a real issue that the NFL is having to deal with, for example.
Steve, what exactly is a stunned neuron, though? If you saw a stunned neuron, could you say, yeah, that's just – I mean, what's going on? Is it something going on with the dendrites, the axons? What really is a stunned neuron?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I don't know that we know exactly what the answer to that is. It's probably not something that you would see, but if you were looking at it what we call electrophysiologically, let's say you had the thing, you know, you had little micro electrical clamps hooked up to the neuron, which is what we actually do in laboratory studies when we're studying neuronal physiology, you would see that it's not responding to signals as quickly. You know, it's not functioning the way it should function, not conducting electricity, you know. The neurons are actually high energy cells. That's why the brain consumes so much energy, 20%, you know, of energy supplies go to the brain. It's because of, you know, maintaining the electrical charge across their membrane and sending the signals requires a lot of energy. So if, you know, the inner mechanisms of the cell are disrupted because they've been physically jostled around, or maybe the membrane's even damaged and it's trying to repair its membrane or repair the myelin, which is the insulation around it, or reestablish its microtubules inside the cell. I mean, there's lots of physical structures that can be disrupted. It's not going to be working well, you know, recycling its neurotransmitters, et cetera. So, you know, basically that's what we mean by it's stunned, just at a physiological subcellular level, things are not working.
What about the support cells, like the glial cells and stuff? Do they have a role in this stunned?
Yeah, that again. The glial cells are traditionally thought of as support cells, but it turns out they actually play a very active role in modulating neuronal function, maybe even in memory and things like that. So it's more complicated than just say that they're there to support the neurons, but they are there to support the neurons and to keep the neurons in a healthy environment and optimally functioning. And sure, they're cells too, and they can be stunned or bruised, you know, with inflammation or disruption, and then that they won't be able to maintain an optimal environment for the neurons as aggressively as they otherwise would. And it can feel like you're drunk. It can feel like you're pharmacologically, you know, you're put your brain in an unfriendly situation, and you can feel out of it. I mean, people know what they feel like when they're sleep deprived, when they're dehydrated, you know, when they're just physically exhausted or overheated, when their blood sugar gets a little low, or these, you know, when they're drunk or under the influence of pain medication or pharmacological medications. There's lots of situations that we may experience where our brains are just not functioning well. And you feel stupid. I mean, I've been like really extremely sleep deprived where I couldn't think straight. You know, you've had that feeling, right, Bob?
Yeah, you're definitely out of it. Definitely, things just
so
are
just
not
about,
flowing.
It's like that. That's what it's like.
Yeah. Steve, do you remember when I got hit by a car years and years ago, riding my bike down our hill?
Yeah.
And not kind of knocked me into this, off the road there on that little hill there by our neighbor's yard. Granted, this is a very old memory. I don't know how reliable it is, but my memory is telling me that after I got hit, what I remember is that I was knocked out. I mean, I think I was knocked out. This is what I remember. I remember all of a sudden kind of coming to, but I was upright. I was kind of holding my arm because my elbow was all messed up. It's not like I woke up and then stood up. It's like
your first memory is of standing up. You're already standing, yeah.
Like long term memories just were not being consolidated for a little while. Yes. So I guess I don't know how long I was out.
Right, right. Yeah, that's one thing. People don't know how long they're out when they're really out. It's just a blank in the time.
Right.
And clearly there was a moment of time when you were coming around when you were able to, you know, wake up, stand up. But you, as you said, you were not processing. You were
right.
Not making new memories. So your memories don't extend into that. You have a little bit of what we call anterograde amnesia, or amnesia after the event, whereas retrograde amnesia is amnesia before the event, which is really interesting when you think about it. You can get knocked in the head and lose your memories for the last few hours. You know, how does that work?
Right. I remember watching a show where somebody set up a fake crime, and they said, I remember getting hit in the head, and the next thing I know, everything was a blank. And the guy's like, sorry, if you got knocked in the head, you wouldn't remember actually getting knocked on the head. You'd be like, oh, I don't know what happened. I just woke up, and you could assume somebody hit you,
yeah.
But it's not like you would feel it. You would remember that moment of being knocked out, because generally you lose those memories.
Yeah, well, again, it's very variable. The worse the injury, the more the greater the duration of the unconsciousness, the more likely you are to have amnesia around either end. You know, there are certainly patients who remember, for example, the car accident. They remember the crash.
Right.
They don't usually. You're right, though. I don't think I've ever had anybody tell me that with a loss of consciousness that they remember the actual moment of being hit in the head, or their head hitting the windshield. They usually only can infer it later. And oftentimes people don't really perceive a loss of consciousness, but they don't have a continuous memory throughout the whole event. And we interpret that as a loss of consciousness. If you can't remember everything all the way through, by definition, there was a loss of consciousness.
Mm.
Do you remember, Bob, when our mother told us the story many times when she was a little girl, that she was riding horseback and fell and hit her head.
Yeah, yeah.
And she lost the entire day.
Yeah.
So from her perspective, she went to bed the night before and then woke up in a hospital bed the next day bruised from head to toe and had no memory of the entire day where the accident occurred.
Yeah, I do remember that.
So that was a little bit of retrograde and anterograde amnesia. So even the day before, even in the Ganayev patients who have the similar experience, even like for the hours following an injury, they're awake, they're talking, they're interacting, but then the next day they remember none of it. They were forming no long-term memories during that period of time.
Like the hippocampus just said, screw this, I'm taking a vacation.
Yeah, or the connections thereof. Yeah, it wasn't functioning at a point where it could actually form any lasting memories.
That's a topic for another conversation, but that is scary. I've seen videos and read about people that can no longer, you know, after say a stroke, they can no longer form any long-term memory. So they're in like this brief 15-minute of now where they exist and they can't really remember anything
beyond that. It's like that movie Memento.
Yeah,
you see that?
Right.
Very clever device for a movie where they basically took the scenes and then they took each like 2 to 3 minute scene and then they just played them backwards. So the audience didn't really remember what happened previously either because they hadn't seen it yet. Mm. Didn't exactly duplicate what he would be experiencing, but it was close enough. It was very, very clever. Yeah, you're right. You have a 3 or whatever 5 minute window of active memory, but no new long-term memory. So you think it's 1980 because that's where your retrograde amnesia goes to. And you've made no new memories since then. You could have 20, 30 years of life where you were forming no new memories. And so you're sort of stuck in that one point in time. Those are extreme cases. Most commonly we see them with severe alcoholics who have thiamine deficiency, and they develop what's called Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome.
This video I saw was so sad. This guy actually wasn't an alcoholic. He had some weird infection that went into his brain, and just fried just that specific part of his brain. And he had some other deficits as well. But, oh, talk about devastating.
It's pretty debilitating. Memories are one of those core functions that we really need to have. Well, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fakerino. There is a theme this week. The theme is big numbers.
And I hate themes and big numbers.
11.
And
Graham's number.
30, 12. Four items instead of three.
No, that's a big number.
What the hell is
a bigger number?
Wait, that increases our odds, doesn't it?
Here they are.
I mean, big numbers.
It's already too complicated. Forget it.
Yeah, I'm confused. Where are we?
You people. I'm going to give you four numbers of things. One of them is incorrect. You have to tell me which one is the fiction.
Oh, okay.
All right, that'll become obvious in a second. Ready? Here we go.
And here we go.
Item number one, the total length of blood vessels in the human body equals 10,000 miles. Item number two, the hottest known temperature in the universe is 7.2 trillion degrees Fahrenheit, recently created in a laboratory by physicists. Item number three, the number of cells in the human body is between 10 and 50 trillion. And item number four, the upper limit of estimates of total number of species ever to have lived on the Earth is 10 billion. Jay, go first.
Oh, God. Item number one. Okay, the total length of blood vessels in the human body, 10,000 miles. I've heard this. And I've often wondered if it was true, and I never thought to look it up until right now again. I don't know.
Go on, wait.
What?
10,000 miles.
Not allowed to be all right,
that, you know what? I think that one is fact. The hottest known temperature in the universe, 7.2 trillion degrees. What? No. How can that be true? How can that be 7.2 trillion degrees? What? How? I don't know. Oh. Phil Plait is going to have to explain this one to me if that's true. The number of cells in the human body, 10 to 50 trillion. Sure. And the upper limit estimates of total number of species ever to have lived on the Earth. That means, like, they're significantly genetically different than the next one. Right?
Yes, well, however you choose to define a species. I mean,
well,
you know,
sure. Who's this? Who is determining this then? Who is the person determining?
Unable to reproduce and produce fertile young.
Is that it? Is that what we're going with, Steve?
Generally,
they're fuzzy around the edges, but you know, certainly an elephant is a different species than a whale.
Jay, I'm going to start my own podcast, and it's going to be called Jay Novella Expresses Disbelief, and I'm just going to take. I'm just going to cut out all of your responses to every science or fiction ever. What? No. What?
Jay, three of these are true.
I'm just saying, listen, you know, when you throw numbers at me, first of all,
like
I'm
four
bad
instead
with math.
Most of the podcast is going to be, I'm just saying.
Just
saying. What?
I'm just saying.
Really? Really?
Really? Really, Steve?
Okay, I'm taking that one as the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
This one is so good, Steve.
From one exasperated novella to another.
This is the best. Yeah, this is the best one you've come up with in a long time.
This is good because
this is an all-time classic.
I mean, I've read a lot of science news, and none of this was covered in it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been waiting to do this until there was a slow news week, and you know, I couldn't find stuff for this week, so I trotted this out.
I found a lot of good stuff you could have used.
You mean should have used.
All right. 10,000 miles of blood vessels. That sounds like too much to me, but it's not off by, say, you know, an order of magnitude type of thing. So I'm going to tentatively go with that one. The number of cells also, 10 to 50 trillion. Yeah, that sounds about right. I don't think that's going to be off by a factor of 10 or 100 either. 2 and 4, though, they're the ones that, like, oh, man, I should know it, but I'm not certain. 7.2 trillion just sounds too high. You know, that's many times hotter than the interiors of pretty much any star that I'm aware of, even the huge ones. But potentially scientists, maybe they could have created that kind of temperature for the briefest amount of time, for the briefest moments. So maybe. But I kind of agree with Jay in terms of the total number of species, but then I'd be agreeing with Jay here, and that's kind of disconcerting.
All right, you guys sorry, Jay. On there. I got half of them right last year. All right, that's not that bad.
Yeah, it's a coin flip. It's
much better than average.
Oh, it is. For,
you know, it's easy for
three
to come off with the smarty pants attitude.
I know. I got.
And that's why next week. I'm doing science or fiction.
I got the Alex Trebek syndrome going.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember his name to say.
No, I'm sorry. The answer is Chile.
Steve, I'm doing science or fiction next week.
Knock yourself out, Jay.
I'm doing it.
with a hammer.
All right, so I'm going to say species. God damn it.
Okay,
oh,
Evan.
It killed you. Just picked that, didn't it?
Oh, this is too hard. Yeah. There. Okay, now I got that out of my system. All right, total length of the blood vessels, 10,000 miles. Now, I remember, Steve, in one of the very, very first skeptic lectures you ever gave, you brought up some interesting facts that were, you had the audience guess, were these real or were they not real? And it was one question to the effect that was like the length of the capillaries, like stretches to the moon, which is roughly 250,000 miles. So, if I only knew how to take that math of capillaries and turn it into blood vessels, I could make the actual equation and figure out if the 10,000 miles is accurate. But you know what? I can't. Moving on.
I think we all learned a lot with that.
I don't think anybody can.
I don't know. Moving on, the hottest known temperature in the universe, 7.2 trillion degrees, recently created in the laboratory by mad scientists. That's hot. That's some hot stuff. I think it's true, though. And then the number of cells in the human body. This is why I don't like about this one, Steve. 10 to 50 trillion? I mean,
well, you got big people and little people, you know.
makes sense.
You don't think there's a five-fold difference in adult size?
Yeah.
From
you got 80-pound people and 400-pound people.
Yeah, you know.
When you're talking about trillions. And then the last one is the upper limit of estimates. Total number of species. You know, I'm not surprised. I want to say that's true.
Say it.
Oh, I guess I might have to.
Please just say it.
I'll go with the blood vessels. I'll say that one is fiction.
Evan, really?
What?
Okay, Rebecca.
Okay, I would like to disagree with everyone else and say that, Steve, this is the absolute worst science fiction ever. Worst, worst, worst. I hate you.
Worst.
Because... ever. I don't know numbers. I can't do it. I can't do numbers.
Best science or fiction ever.
Four choices. Hold up your hand and put down your thumb. That's how many choices.
I don't know what it is. Maybe it's related to my face blindness that I can't, you know, I can't remember faces. Maybe
that
something.
Prosopagnosia?
Yes. Maybe
ooh,
it's
nasty.
Kind of in the same brain region.
It is kind
know.
Of in the roughly the same brain region.
Is it?
Yeah,
roughly.
Oh, look at that. My completely unscientific guess pays off.
Well,
and now I have
how are your phone
pieces.
Numbers,
a trillion of those cells, right?
Phone numbers, I know one. Does that count? It's mine.
That's good.
The one you never have to call.
Right. Well,
how,
yeah,
how
you have to give it out.
But you always
anyway.
Have to.
So anyway, the point is, not only do I not know the answer to this at all, but I don't even remember what everybody else picked. So I'm just going to go with whatever Bob said.
Oh.
Which means you're also going with Jay. All right,
man,
then.
Really?
I know.
Oh, really? Really?
So I guess we'll start with number two. The hottest known temperature in the universe is 7.2 trillion degrees Fahrenheit, recently created in the laboratory by physicists. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yay!
Yay. Nice.
At that point, at that small point where they heated the air or whatever, to that temperature, what the hell's going
fusion?
On?
Is it the fusion reactor, Steve?
Melt?
This is the Department of Energy's Brookhaven National Laboratory in New York have created the hottest temperature matter ever measured in the universe. Actually, they used a giant atom smasher, relativistic heavy ion collider, and they took gold particles and crashed them into each other billions of times, creating a quark gluon plasma.
Plasma, yeah. It's like one of the right. state
All right,
of matter.
Bob, you know what? You didn't know anything about this. So quiet.
The experiment is recreating the conditions of the universe a few microseconds after the Big Bang.
I don't want them to heat anything that hot ever again.
Just think about how the Jiffy Pop popcorn would go up.
Why didn't the whole building just melt around that?
Because it's not that much.
I mean,
it's tiny, Jay. It's super tiny, super brief duration. That's
because
that's how.
It's too hot.
It's Fahrenheit, not Celsius, Jay.
All right, let's go on to number three. The number of cells in the human body, 10 to 50 trillion, and that one is also
science.
Yeah.
So far, so good for everyone.
Nice.
So that wasn't the one I picked.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yay.
I still don't like that range.
So, Steve, you really don't have to go into an explanation about that one, right? That's just the numbers. There's nothing
yes,
to really say.
That's right. 10 to 50 trillion cells. Yeah, I mean, there are just a range of estimates. No one's actually counted them. You calculate them by cell size and whatnot. And there are variations in how big people are, so that's why there's a range there. Let's go on to number four, the upper limit of estimates. Of total number of species ever to have lived on the Earth is 10 billion. Bob, Jay, and Rebecca all think this one is the fiction. Evan, you think this one is science. And this one is science.
Oh, God.
Sorry, Rebecca.
Damn.
Damn it, Bob. I trusted you.
It's lonely over here.
Now, again,
Steve, you know what? Bullshit.
He's calling shenanigans on you.
So the estimate for the number of current species, I know we've talked about this on the show before, is somewhere between 10 and 100 million, even if we accept the lower number of 10 million. But we have to now, say, extrapolate that for hundreds of millions of years, where the average species lives somewhere between 2 and 4 million years, and the number of species that were present at any one time, assuming it started as one species and then increased from there, and you get a range of estimates. But again, I said this is the upper limit of estimates.
See, this one sucked. I can't wait for Jay's science fiction.
Which
is so much better.
Wasn't all that bad.
The total length of blood vessels in the human body, 10,000 miles. That one, Evan, is the fiction.
My not so helpful capillary analogy actually helped me.
It was true. Actually, the number is 100,000. It's a lot more.
Wow.
And again, this range of estimates, but 100,000 is about average.
So nobody ever did this, is what you're saying, though.
What do you mean?
Laid it out.
No.
Well, then how do you know?
It's an estimate based upon knowledge of anatomy.
So basically, all these numbers except the temperature one are estimates.
That's correct.
I'm sorry. This whole thing is void. Thank you.
You're not even going to send him your file, Jay. Right?
Jay, whenever you're dealing with huge numbers like that, of course they're going to be estimates.
Well,
no one's going to be able to count 50 trillion cells.
They start now. Really?
It's a little bit different this week, but thanks for playing along, guys.
A little bit different. You mean a little bit sucky, right?
Yeah. I liked it. Well, Jay, why don't you give us a quote?
Okay, so this is a quote from Mark Twain.
Samuel Clemens.
All you need is ignorance and confidence, and the success is sure. Mark Samuel Clemens Twain.
I think it would go the other way around.
Samuel Mark Twain Clemens. No?
He'd have been amused, I think.
Yeah, I think he would have liked that.
He was all about humor.
Rebecca, tell me your announcement.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked in such a nice way. I have two announcements, and I demand that they both be left in this week, Steve.
Two? Well, we'll see.
Two. They're both good, though.
Let's hear them.
Announcement number one is that I actually do have a new podcast called Curiosity Aroused, which you may remember was the name of the pilot show I did for NPR.
Right.
Well, we decided, the skeptics and I decided, that we would launch a new podcast that was good for people who don't know what skeptics are and might not even be looking in the science section of iTunes. So we would maybe sneak up on them a bit. So you can find that on iTunes now and also at curiosityaroused.com. That will be a lot of fun. And then the other announcement is that if you go to bostonskeptics.com, you will see that the Boston Skeptics at Skeptics in the Pub are hosting Jeff Lieberman of Time Warp, which is a show on the Discovery Channel. And he's going to be there February 22nd, Monday, at 7 p.m. And all the info is at bostonskeptics.com. Good times.
Yay.
Sounds awesome.
Good
times. You miss Boston, don't you?
I miss Boston very much, yes. Especially when they're having awesome guests.
And we'd like to remind you that we're 2 months away, exactly, from the Northeast Conference on Science or Skepticism, April 17th in New York, New York. Registrations are filling up quickly, so go to the website and register. And registration has also opened for the dinner. There are 50 slots for guests who can join all of the speakers of the Nexus, including the SGU crew, for dinner on Saturday night after the conference. And again, it's first come, first serve. So if you want to assure that you get a seat, please go to the nexuscon.com website. And
I'm going to be there.
And yes, Rebecca will be there.
We get to see you again, Rebecca. How awesome.
Although that shouldn't deter any listeners who hate me, because I'm very easy to ignore. But for everybody else,
Rebecca, is Sid coming?
Yes, Sid is coming as well.
Special guest.
That's awesome.
Yay. So in addition to registering for the conference and the speaker's dinner, you can also pre-order the Nexus t-shirts, which we'll have available for sale at the conference. Special Nexus 2010 limited edition t-shirt.
And a wet t-shirt contest to follow.
Yay!
Jackass. Well, thank you for joining me again.
You're
everyone.
Welcome.
Surely. Oh, thank
well
you.
Met.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Red October signing off.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.